From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, legal questions surrounding federal agents sent to cities like Portland or Detroit.
But I also think there's a pretty compelling argument made in the case that the DHS officers who have been deployed in Portland are actually being deployed beyond their legal authority.
A constitutional law expert joins us today. Also, how one school in the UP prepares for unique challenges faced in reopening.
I believe there's a high level of anxiety in our staff members, in our parents, in our community, in everybody in general right now.
Plus, a little viewing to take the edge off isolation. What would you say to a bit of the bard?
We have sword fights with lightsabers, or we've had a sword be a giant cucumber. Batman has made an appearance. There's been a puppet show. We've had a terrifying clown make an appearance.
Shakespeare comes to the Zoom meeting. Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Many Detroiters have been watching protest action on the streets of Portland, Oregon, and wondering if our city will be next to meet the federal officers charged with fighting back against demonstrators. Today on the program, we're going to get a legal opinion on the urban deployment of security forces, usually used for border patrol or other actions.
The federal government can't just come in because there's a violent crime that local authorities, say in Detroit, haven't done enough to investigate. There actually has to be a clear federal constitutional interest.
That's on the way in the second half of today's show. But first, there is so much for school districts to get done before this fall. It's certainly true in the densely populated towns of southeast Michigan. But we were also curious about the COVID-related challenges for Michigan's rural districts, with relatively small student populations and relatively large areas to cover. How can rural schools plan to keep students and community safe? Tom McKee is the superintendent of the Whitefish Township School District in the Upper Peninsula. Tom, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So for those who've never had the pleasure, Whitefish Township is north of the bridge and a bit west of Sault Ste. Marie. Folks may know Whitefish Point with its beautiful beaches and the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum. What can you tell us about the COVID caseload in the area these days?
Yeah, so while we are a tourist destination, we're paradise is the town name in Whitefish Township, where our school resides. And it's that during the months of May to about September, this is paradise up here. It's home to 520 year-round or seasonal residents, permanent residents. So we don't have a lot of cases right now. We have a lot of people, I think, that look at paradise and come up here to escape some of the more dense areas, which is good for our economy. But yet it's scary in that our average age of citizens are 68 in our town. So there's some people that are a little concerned, some people that are a little worried about everybody coming up here. And I know once schools get back in session, the flow of people will slow down.
All the same, it looks like Chippewa County has recorded at least a couple dozen confirmed cases right now. And again, all those folks coming up for summer, I know that many of them wear masks, but they're people just the same. Are you getting any feel for what expectations parents have or what their concerns might be for having kids in school, or what teachers might be thinking about, what their concerns are for this fall?
I believe there's a high level of anxiety in our staff members, in our parents, in our community, and in everybody in general right now. There's a lot of anxiety surrounding schools and opening them back up, and what do we do? And one of the things that our school district has been trying to do since the beginning is ease that fear and stress as much as we can. We are going to follow our local health department's recommendations. We are going to do our research with the CDC and what guidance they put out. And we're going to take our parents' best wishes into consideration, because ultimately that's who we answer to, our parents and our community members. That's who we're here to serve in our efforts to partner with them to make sure that our students have the best possible learning opportunities that we can provide. So we are setting up a plan for all different phases, and hoping that we can accomplish that together.
Yeah. You have, I want to say, upwards of 50 students in the district?
We do. We actually, we have 60 students total, K-12, which makes us one of the smaller K-12 schools in the state of Michigan. That was very appealing to a lot of people this spring, where we had to close our school of choice window down for a period because we had 34 students that had reached out to try to enroll into our district, and with the uncertainties of budgets and the uncertainties of physical distancing requirements, we had to shut our school of choice window down, but we could have been looking at right about 100 students total.
You're saying that people in some of the surrounding areas were actually looking your way saying, hey, maybe this is a good option for us as we try to get our kids in a more distance situation?
Yeah, so I always joke with the other superintendents because we have quite a good relationship. But my staff is the best in the state at our school, and I would put that up against anybody. But it's always helpful when you have 8 students to 1 staff member, and that's something that at Whitefish Township Community Schools we can offer. We offer that 8 students per class. You know, we have some electives where you are one of 3 students in your class, and that's very appealing to parents and to students alike.
Right. I imagine that transportation has to be pretty close to the top of your list of concerns with those 60 kids spread over about, 270 square miles. What do you feel like you need to do to keep the bus rides safe this year?
Well, that's the one thing that that we are actually not going to budge, whether we are in phase 5, phase 4 of the Michigan Safe Restart Plan. We are going to require all bus riders to wear a mask. When we're in school, there are times that the kids will, you know, be able to remove the masks or not have them. But we are not budging on our buses. All students will be spread out. We're going to have to run another bus, which is going to be extra cost to pick up our students, but they will be all required to wear a mask.
As you say, the district serves kids from kindergarten all the way up to grade 12. Are you worried about the littles being able to keep their masks on, whether it's during bus rides or once they get to school?
Yeah, we've been trying our best to educate our parents and have the students practice now. We've been kind of imploring our parents to put the mask on your kids for 45 minutes a day and make it a game. But once students in K-5 get to our school and they're in their classrooms, they won't have to wear their masks. We will, unless the parents require it, we're going to allow them to remove them because we understand the, you know, the kind of the health concerns, but we also understand the inability for a young child to not fiddle with it.
Yeah, this might be the longest 45 minutes of a first grader's life.
Yeah. So we're going to, when they're on the bus, they have to wear their mask. When they're in a common area, like the hallway, they have to wear their masks. But we're going to kind of cohort our groups of kids so that they're always going to be with the same group. It kind of helps with contact tracing, this making sure that if something happens, we just have one pod of students that we need to make sure are okay. So that's kind of how we're going to roll with it. They'll be in the same classroom. We'll be doing a lot of outdoor classroom work, which my teachers have done, you know, the years past, and now it's becoming something that everybody's wants to do. So we kind of have a step ahead of the game there.
Hmm. Are there other ways that the school day might be different this year?
Yeah, our school is going to go 4 days a week. We're going to go Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, face-to-face. Our Fridays are going to be done online. that's going to be something that is unique. I understand some of the more dense areas would have some child care issues. We're looking at it as a way to give our staff a platform to have their online classes done, because that's what we'll be doing on those Fridays. Is they'll be working the students with the students online in their classes. But that way, we're always weekly hitting that online classes, because you never know if there's going to be another massive statewide shutdown as things get going. So this is a way that we're going to get our kids practicing every week how to log into the online classroom, do some of the assignments. It also keeps the teachers logged in, uploading the assignments and things like that. So it's just a way that we thought would be good for us to always have our thumb on that piece of it.
You know, one of the things that I know was challenging for the task force that worked on recommendations for schools was trying to figure out stuff that would work in Southeast Michigan, as well as up north and in less densely populated areas. Do you feel like at this point you have the flexibility that you need?
That's a great question. I know that the task force and any state agency that's put together for education, what's good for Paradise is not good for Petoskey. What works up here won't work down there. I think they did a good job with some of the flexibility, but just like everything else, when there's some accountability, I wish there was a way that we could increase local control and provide more, what's a nice way of putting it, more trust in the superintendents of schools in their districts. But then again, I understand the accountability measures that are needed, and making sure that we do our things with fidelity.
Mr. McKee, we wish you a safe school year this fall, and we want to thank you for taking some time to talk to us about it.
Well, thank you for having me on, and hopefully we can have you guys up here soon and check out what we have to offer.
Most definitely. Tom McKee is superintendent of the Whitefish Township District. Sci-fi weapons, superhero cameos, and do-it-yourself props. This is definitely not your parents' production of Shakespeare. The Midland Center for the Arts is taking advantage of this crisis moment to push Shakespeare into the 21st century. We will hear their voices in a moment. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Have you been in quarantine so long that you have run out of things to watch on Netflix? Coming to your rescue, the Midland Center for the Arts. Its company of actors has launched a weekly project, Shakespeare and Chill Live. That's right, every Friday night at 9, a team of thespians performs a live production of one of Shakespeare's plays over Zoom. All right, so we're going to listen to the Midland Center for the Arts Zoom production of Midsummer Night's Dream. I want you to imagine the actors set against background images of a woodland at night. The actor who's playing the hapless weaver, Bottom, has entered the Zoom meeting with a spell cast upon him, turning him into a donkey. The Midland actor has put a digital donkey head filter over his picture. The actress playing the fairy queen Titania has her eyes closed with a digital crown of flowers across her forehead.
This is a knavery of them to make me a fur. I see their knavery. This is to make an ass of me, to frighten me. If they could, but I will not stir from this place. Do what they can. I will walk up and down here, and I will sing that they shall hear. I am not afraid. The woosel cock, so black of hue, with orange tawny bill. The throstle with his notes so true. The wren with little quill.
What angel wakes me from my flowery bed? I pray thee, gentle mortal, sing again. Mine ear is much enamored of thy note, so is mine eye enthralled to thy shape. and my fair virtue perforce doth force me to move me on the first view to say, to swear, I love thee.
Methinks, mistress, you should have little reason for that. And yet, to say the truth, reason and love keep little company together nowadays.
The Center is planning to perform all 37 plays in the canon this year. They are a little over halfway through. And Anon, here to tell us more, is Dexter Brigham, Director of Theater Programs at the Midland Center for the Arts. What ho, Dexter!
Hello there, how are you?
I'm getting by. You kicked off the series with a performance of As You Like It. Could you tell us a little bit about how this thing got started?
Yeah, so, the middle of March, all of our programming at Midland Center for the Arts came to a screeching halt. And me and my colleagues on the programming team all came together and said, well, how do we meet our mission of providing meaning and connection to everyone who's kind of within our region? How do we do that if we can't come together in a place? Like, what we do is we come together in theaters and in concert halls. And how do we do that? And at first, I was really skeptical about this idea of live streamed Zoom performances. And then I watched a performance of Two Gentlemen of Verona that was done in a Zoom format by a group called The Show Must Go Online. And I was like, oh, well, that really kind of provides proof of concept for me. Like, that's actually pretty innovative and fun. And so we were thinking, hey, you know, we got a few weeks where we will be creating this type of programming until this whole thing blows over very quickly. Like, of course, it's going to blow over very quickly. So let's do a few of these. And so we settled on presenting As You Like It. You know, there's a character in As You Like It, Jaques, who is known for his melancholy. And as we all settled into our quarantines and
our societal melancholy.
Yes, our societal melancholy, where we all would stay indoors for weeks at a time, only going out to grocery shop and, you know, kind of dealing with that cabin fever. It seemed appropriate. You know, Jaques, you know, most famous speech is the all the world's a stage and the seven stages of man. And, you know, it's kind of like Jaques is like the perfect kind of spirit animal for the melancholy moment that we're in terms of spending a spring and a summer the way we are. So that was a great kind of launching point for us. And then we actually spent a week doing an evening of sonnets. We're like, oh, let's shake it up and do some sonnets, you know, so we did that pretty early on. But then after a few weeks, it became clear that this was going to go on for a while and that there really wasn't any end in sight. And, you know, we really started to be worried. I mean, we're still worried as an arts organization that what we do can't be done for quite a while. But we took a look at the Shakespeare and Show Live program. We said, you know what? This is exactly what we should be doing. You know, we have artists that we're engaging every single week. We have new artists that are coming in. At this point, we're coming up on almost 100 actors who have engaged in the program. We also have anywhere from 2,000 to 7,000 audience members who watch our videos each week.
I think it's safe to say that the thing that works about this is when the cast is just leaning in just enough to the artifice of what's going on, that this is an online performance. It's not a staged play. What kinds of things have you been telling people about how they might alter their performance as they're in their homes doing these lines?
So every single week, every Thursday night, we have a first table read and technical rehearsal and dress rehearsal all at the same time. We have exactly one rehearsal each week. And I spend like about the first 20, 30 minutes of that rehearsal kind of talking all the new folks through the medium. Because part of this has been just the fun of exploring the medium. And one of the things that we've learned is that I call it the GoPro style of performance. You know, we don't try to actually have our actors, you know, turn to someone else who's in a different Brady Bunch box and try to create the illusion that they're talking to each other. When audiences are watching on screens, I think they're very aware of the fact that we're all in boxes. So instead, we go for the GoPro approach, where everyone is interacting directly with their webcam, and we pass props back and forth between our homes. We make sure that we have matching props, and we do all of our fight scenes. But the main thing that we realized was that there are limitations. An audience needs to be in the same place at the same time with a group of actors in order to weave that spell of imagination that we associate with live theater. And when you're sitting in bed with a drink in your hand and you're watching some people on a screen who are all look like the opening scroll of Brady Bunch, there's limitations to that. And so what we decided to do is that our two main goals are, number one, to engage with the language and to allow anyone who's performing or who is watching to really enjoy the beauty of the language and the rhythm and the poetry. And then number two, to just surprise people. We've created an environment where we just say yes to pretty much everything. And I tell people, you know, you guys are pulling these things from your closets and from your refrigerators. Props are just coming from, it's crazy, right? Everything is just kind of nuts. And so we decide on a theme for the week, a concept for the approach. And people will check in on me about certain ideas. But for the most part, I say, unless it's something that's really far out there, and even sometimes if it is really far out there, I encourage them to do it. So there's an improvisational element to our weekly performances, where during the shows, both the actors and the audience are seeing a lot of these costumes and a lot of these choices that the actors are making for the first time. And so, you know, between the language and then constantly being surprised by somebody entering with a new, completely outlandish costume, or we have sword fights with lightsabers, or we've had a sword be a giant cucumber. Batman has made an appearance. There's been a puppet show. We've had a terrifying clown make an appearance. That kind of like surprise and delight dynamic of just constantly kind of shocking and delighting our audience and trying to see how we can surprise them each week. It's kind of part of the fun of it.
I like the cucumber sword adaptation a lot. Is there another weirdest prop nominee that you'd like to share with us?
I would say that it's Shakespeare. So naturally we go through all of the goriest of tragedies. You know, so we've gone through Titus Andronicus and King Lear. You know, some of the things that people have come up with for the severed heads. You know, I think we've had like small little baby doll heads. We've had sports balls with faces driven on them. In Titus Andronicus, we had a character who, you know, she has her hands cut off and her tongue cut out. Our actor had red mittens on her hands and she filled her mouth with like red syrup, did a fabulous job of not speaking for the entire scene until the moment that she opened her mouth. And then she opened her mouth and it all just poured out of her mouth and died. It was quite effective. It was really, really wonderful.
Best Lavinia ever.
Yes.
Dexter, Shakespeare lived hundreds of years ago, but this man knew something about writing during a plague. The bubonic plague was ravaging England, I want to say, most of his life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think from the online feedback that you're getting that there's anything that's resonated in the highly unusual moment that everyone's living through so far?
Definitely, especially among the artists. I think this project has really served to clear away the static, the 400 years of static between us and this guy who lived 400 years ago, who had all of the same love of theater and was doing a lot of the same things that we are. You have this guy who, you know, moved to the big city when he was a young man, and him and his closest friend started a little theater company together. They managed to get a grant from the government, you know, so they were basically a nonprofit theater. And here's this guy who's trying to just write hits. He's trying to write things that are funny and dirty and have big action scenes and, you know, that just catering to his audience, something that's going to sell, while also trying to, at the same time, to create high art. And it's easy to feel disconnected from Shakespeare, to have him feel like he's very far away, rather than being somebody who's exactly like all of our playwright friends or all of our artist friends. And by doing the plays every week, both our artists and our audiences really get a sense of the similarities in these plays, that Shakespeare was writing for a group of men that he knew. And so you begin to see the consistency. You know, here he's writing for Conning, and then here he's writing for Hemings. Mm-hmm. She's writing for these specific men, and you start seeing these, you know, the character consistencies, you know, like that Helena and Hermia are these two young men. You have one who's tall and fair-haired and is fabulous with language and witty, and you have one who's short and dark-haired, who's really strikingly beautiful. And then you see those types, those archetypes of actors that have those skills popping up in every single show. You have, you know, you have the same thing with Beatrice and Hero in Much Ado About Nothing. And it's really wonderful to clear away all of that baggage and see the inner workings of this theater company that was struggling to make a living 400 years ago. As we keep doing the research on each one of the weekly plays, it pops up every so often. Well, you know, this series of plays, everyone believes that this was when the theaters were closed in 1591 for 6 months because there was a big wave of plague hitting London. it's kind of neat to get those little pieces of insight.
Wow. We should say, anyone hearing this right now from Midland or anyone who's driven through Midland right now, your community has been through a few things lately. As if the pandemic weren't enough and the serious consequences it's had for creative people and people who love art and who love theater, can you give me an idea of what things would be like at the center right now if there were not a pandemic?
Well, yeah. Oh, my gosh. So we had so much lined up for the spring. The national tour of Cats coming through. We had a big community production of A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. We had a symphony concert, like the big finale for our symphony season that was planned. We had a whole summer of summer camps. You know, usually we have hundreds and hundreds of children in our building every day attending dozens of summer camps in June, July, and August. And all of those had to be canceled, both for the pandemic, but also because the Center for the Arts, we suffered about $9 million of damage to our facilities during the flooding.
I think most people know that there was dam failure at two dams in the Tri-County region, and the damage can be seen to this day, and it's really serious. What has happened to programming? Was it just a situation where you had to cancel absolutely everything?
Well, we have been very highly engaged with everyone in the entire arts sector across the nation. I mean, the entire arts sector across the nation is shut down. And so we've been talking to our colleagues in the Broadway world, in the presented concerts, in national tours. We've been talking to other symphonies and other theater companies. I'm on multiple webinars each week, just talking with other theater colleagues about what are false, you know, like, well, when are you planning on reopening? How are you planning on reopening? You know, are you planning on removing seats? How do you plan on avoiding crowding? Are you doing concessions? Are you requiring masks? Are there capacity restrictions? How are you staying afloat financially? And there are definitely trends that are starting to emerge. I can't say best practices because no one's practiced anything. So we're all just kind of making it up as we go along. But there are good ideas that are beginning to surface. And I'm hopeful that by the time we get into the fall, we will have figured out those best practices, the best things that we can do to relaunch our programming, and that we can convince our various community leaders to let us do that, you know, because the regulatory environment, of course, that's always a challenge. But if we can assure them that we will be keeping our patrons safe, then we can start the process of convincing our patrons that they will be safe coming to us.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, watching your Shakespeare and Chill productions, I was just thinking, there are probably some people here who got flooded out of their homes. There are probably people here who've been out of work for a long time. I was just amazed that you were able to find actors who could find it in themselves to keep on doing this.
Yeah. I mean, I have some folks who are there with me every single week. I've got about four or five actors who've done all 17 weeks in a row. We have folks that float in and out. You know, and, you know, during the weeks around the flood, it was tough, you know, to decide whether we were going to move forward or not, whether we felt that it was appropriate. And we just make sure that we were talking with everybody. And we felt that what we would be able to do is provide, you know, just a late night diversion. But it also brought us together to be able to talk about it, you know? So it's not like we're pretending that these things haven't happened, you know? Like, you know, I think the flooding happened, you know, the most of it happened on like a Tuesday, Wednesday, and that Friday in our performance, you know, we sat in that space for a couple of minutes and talked about it and sent our thoughts and prayers out to the folks who were just digging themselves out. And it's also been a nice way to connect people and encourage people to give and let them know what resources are available for help if they needed help with abatement or if they wanted to know where to donate or where they could volunteer. We've been able to share that as well on the live stream.
Do you have a favorite of the shows so far?
Yeah. I mean, every week is fantastic and it's always new. But for me, it's about the unexpected ones. I've worked on about, you know, maybe 2/3 of the plays at some point in my career. But there's lots that you never get a chance to come across. Time of Athens, you know, is a play that just people don't do. And I think if I could say two, I would say first one would be Time of Athens, because it's an unusually straightforward plot for Shakespeare.
That is the last play I expected you to mention.
Well, it doesn't, because it just doesn't get any bandwidth. It doesn't get any attention.
There hasn't been a Franco Zeffirelli adaptation of Timon of Athens.
That is true. But the thing that's interesting about it is that it's a very clear collaboration with another playwright. And it's a playwright who's much younger, and you can really sense the different voices. In a lot of ways, it's a lot more rough around the edges because it really is a conversation between two talented playwrights with very different voices. And it's really, really interesting in that way. Although I would say, in terms of just straightforward, just admiration for the man himself, I really enjoyed Richard III. It's just breathtakingly sinister and unnerving and beautiful. It's just a fabulous. It is as good as, you know, any violent political thriller you might find on Netflix.
Well, Dexter, thank you so much for talking to us about the series, and we can't wait to see what you're coming up with.
Oh, well, hey, thanks a lot.
Dexter Brigham is director of theater programs for the Midland Center for the Arts. In other stories we're following, the Trump administration is sending more federal officers to Portland, Oregon, and is threatening to do the same for cities like Detroit. But can it happen?
The notion that the federal government can just go into a city where there's violent crime and clean up the violent crime is actually a notion the Supreme Court has specifically rejected.
After the break, we'll dig into how a president might argue the legal authority to send in federal forces with no clear warrant. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you've been on social media or taken in the national news in any way the past couple of weeks, we're guessing you're probably aware of the harrowing clashes taking place in Portland, Oregon, between protesters and police. In recent weeks, these violent scenes have involved federal agents, personnel from the U.S. Marshals Service, but also from the Border Patrol and other arms of the Department of Homeland Security. President Trump sent them to Oregon to deal with what he called the city's inability to stop the nightly Black Lives Matter protests. There's been a lot of tear gas, peaceful protesters shot with less lethal ammunition, and some very unusual tactics for arrest. Now the president says he's preparing to send more troops to other cities, and Detroit was on his list. Steve Vladek is a professor at the University of Texas School of Law and also co-hosts the National Security Law Podcast. We wanted to talk to him about precedents governing these cases. Steve Vladek, welcome to Stateside.
Yes, April. Great to be with you.
You know, not to get too Portland-centric, but the situation out there is so unusual. The state's attorney general tried to sue the Trump administration to stop some of the practices that federal officers were using, and a federal judge actually found that the state did not have standing in this matter of whether federal officers should be on the ground. Did that surprise you at all?
Not really, April. I mean, I think the Supreme Court in recent years has been pretty resistant to the idea that states can sue the federal government whenever their citizens are harmed. And also, I mean, unlike some other contexts, I think it's not hard here to find some individual people who actually really would have standing. I mean, so there was a new lawsuit filed yesterday on behalf of a group called Don't Shoot Portland that I think is a much cleaner case from the perspective of representing individual protesters and a few folks who even allege that they were wrongfully arrested. So, you know, it's not, I think, the norm or the best idea to have states being the lead litigants in this context. I think it makes a lot more sense to do what this new lawsuit is doing, which is have the individuals who are most directly harmed be the ones bringing the claims.
So this new lawsuit filed yesterday, again, is the activist taking their shot. There are three advocacy groups represented and five individual protesters. And they're accusing the Department of Homeland Security of violating protesters' right to freedom of speech, freedom from unreasonable seizures, and they also mentioned due process. Why do you think this suit will be significant?
Well, I think it's not just those constitutional claims which are really important, but I also think there's a pretty compelling argument made in the case that the DHS officers who have been deployed in Portland are actually being deployed beyond their legal authority. So this is a claim under the Administrative Procedure Act that basically the CBP officers on the ground, the Federal Protective Service officers on the ground, of course they have the authority to arrest for federal offenses. But that doesn't give them the general authority to do shows of force, to do this kind of counter-protest maneuvering that we've seen. And so I think, you know, it's very possible this lawsuit is not only going to resolve some of the factual disputes over exactly what's happened, but also, you know, very possibly cabin the federal government's authority to sort of closer to the exact letter of the statutes that they're operating under.
The lawsuit filed yesterday also questions whether the acting Homeland Security chief within the administration, Chad Wolf, is acting legally. He has not, as of this time, been confirmed by the Senate. Do you have any thoughts on whether that's a powerful method of questioning what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it's a very important part of the story, not just that there's no Senate-confirmed Secretary of Homeland Security, and there hasn't been since April of 2019, which is the longest vacancy in the history of the U.S. cabinet, but that none of the senior positions at DHS are filled by Senate-confirmed officials. The challenge to Chad Wolf especially, I think, is a little bit weaker than, for example, the challenge to whether Ken Cuccinelli can really call himself the acting deputy secretary. But the larger point, I think, is a really important part of the story, which is that here we have officials who have not had to run the gauntlet of Senate confirmation, who don't have, you know, any stakeholders to whom they're beholden besides the president. And I think that's a big part of how we got here. And frankly, I mean, I think we have to be clear. It's a big part of why the president has prioritized using Department of Homeland Security resources in a context in which we might have historically expected the Department of Justice.
There are discussions that can be had about what has or has not been done to or on federal property in Portland, Oregon. But I wanted to ask you a bit about the president's promises of future deployments and how this might play out, say, in Detroit. The administration has had two stated reasons for sending troops into cities: protests, but also suggesting that there needs to be a crackdown on gun violence. Can the federal government do that, just step in it as a policing agent?
I mean, the short answer is not really. So, the federal government, of course, has the power to enforce federal law. And, you know, federal criminal law is a pretty impressively broad compendium of prohibitions. But it's not universal. I mean, so the federal government can't just come in because there's a violent crime that local authorities, say, in Detroit haven't done enough to investigate. There actually has to be a clear federal constitutional interest. So, you know, drug crimes tend to be a pretty good hook for the federal government. Some kinds of especially large-scale violent crimes, if they're related to interstate gangs, you know, that gets the federal government's authority, I think, on board. But the notion that the federal government can just go into a city where there's violent crime as such and clean up the violent crime as such is actually a notion the Supreme Court has specifically rejected as recently as 2000 in a case called United States versus Morrison.
I noticed that six American mayors, all of them Democrats, we should say, including Chicago's Mayor Lori Lightfoot, are asking Congress right now to pass a bill that would require consent before sending in federal officers. I mean, first of all, given the case you just cited, is that really needed?
So I don't think it's needed. And also, I mean, April, I'm not sure it's a great idea. I mean, we have examples throughout American history of the federal government going into cities and states that didn't want them to enforce federal laws that I think we're all a lot more comfortable with. President Eisenhower sent the army into Little Rock to enforce school desegregation orders. President Kennedy did the same in Mississippi and Alabama. So I'm not sure we want to create a world where local and state authorities can basically just sort of veto federal enforcement of federal law. I think the far better solution here is for us to paint a much clearer picture on where the line is between what the federal government's allowed to enforce and what really is the primary, if not exclusive, responsibility of local and state authorities.
Mm-hmm. So what does the Constitution say about states and their right to exclude federal officers if they see fit? I mean, it feels like this was sort of a big issue in the eyes of the founders.
Yeah, I mean, you know, federalism is, of course, one of our most enduring constitutional principles. But one of the key things about federalism is that where the federal government is acting within its lawful sphere, and of course, that's the big fight in Portland, states aren't allowed to exclude them because federal authority has to be supreme where it's valid. And so that's why I think, you know, a lot of the conversations about Portland and about future deployments are missing, I think, a big part of the puzzle, which is, the question is not, should the federal government ever be able to do this? The question is the federal government acting within its statutory and constitutional authority today? And I think that's a big part of why this new lawsuit is such a big deal, because the center of that lawsuit is trying to define the outer boundaries the statutory power that the Department of Homeland Security has to engage in these kinds of law enforcement missions.
Well, as you pointed out, there certainly have been times like with school desegregation where the federal government has been within its constitutional rights to do that. Can you take us a little bit further into how the courts have made that definition in the past?
Sure. I mean, I think the short version is that the central question is simply whether the federal government has the valid authority to do what it's doing. And if it does, then the state or local government that's objecting is just out of luck. Then its only remedies are the political remedies of trying to change the leadership of the federal government. And so the question is not who has a better policy between, say, Detroit or Michigan and the federal government. The question is simply, is the federal government doing something it's allowed to do? If it is, then that's the end of the matter so far as courts are concerned. And that's why I think the real question in Portland is, you know, how far beyond just protecting federal property have these federal agents, these CBP officers, gone?
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Steve Vladek. He's professor at the University of Texas School of Law and has been thinking and talking about national security law in the context of protests in the streets on the West Coast. Part of what has informed this case law is a piece of congressional law called the Insurrection Act. Can you explain what it is and sort of why it's become an important concept in these cases?
Sure. I mean, so the Insurrection Act is actually a terrible name for a series of five statutes that date back all the way to 1792. And these are the statutes that allow for the president to use the military when things have really gotten out of hand on the ground, when local and or state governments are either unwilling or unable to enforce federal law. And so the idea is that in truly extreme circumstances, the proper way to restore order is to go through the military. First, to go through, say, the state National Guard. And if the governor won't call out the state guard, then to federalize the guard or even call in the army. This is clearly an authority the president has, but you know, there's a reason why we've gone 28 years since any president last used it, when President George H.W. Bush used it during the Rodney King riots in L.A. It's very unpopular. It's not an authority that the federal government likes to exercise, especially when states haven't asked for it. And so I think that sort of puts this all into context that, you know, going back throughout history, if there really was sustained, prolonged unrest or disorder in American cities, you know, it was the military that we used to restore order. It was the military that was trained to do that. It's the National Guard that's used to doing riot control. And one of the really alarming things about what's going on in Portland is that by moving away from the trained, disciplined, politically constrained military to the Department of Homeland Security, which has no real history of serving this mission, you know, it suggests that the real goal is not actually restoring order, but that the real goal is the optics, and is, you know, the political points of being able to say, look, you know, we're restoring order our way. It's all the Democrats' fault. I think that's really a dangerous precedent to set by turning this into a partisan issue as opposed to a, you know, everyone's on the same page and getting things working again kind of issue.
Well, I know you're not, I know you're a law professor, not a specialist in police tactics, but what differences do you see playing out when we have people trained to do border patrols doing this kind of urban crowd control?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one of the things that seems to be happening based on the videos we're seeing out of Portland is a lot more confrontation than you're necessarily going to expect when you have, say, the National Guard establishing a cordon and imposing a curfew. I think we've seen arrests that are clearly inconsistent with the governing constitutional standard, where individuals are being arrested without probable cause, perhaps because the Border Patrol, you know, in its primary function is used to arresting individuals for whom that's not an issue, because they're arresting folks who have just surreptitiously crossed the border. So, you know, I think this goes back to the larger problem, which is that when, you know, the Trump administration says we have every right to be there, we're protecting federal property, we're enforcing federal law, that's true in the abstract. The question is, how much is that actually what's happening on the ground? And how much is what we're seeing actually much more than that, in ways that may not only be beyond the statutory authority of the federal government, but that may be violating individuals' Fourth Amendment rights?
Does this feel to you like a different standard and a different precedent? I mean, is something happening here that has not happened before?
I do think there are some factual idiosyncrasies to what's going on in Portland. Putting the Department of Homeland Security on the front line is not something we've seen before in this context. This kind of, I think, aggressive federal provocation of protesters is not something we've seen, certainly at least in, you know, 50 years since the late 1960s. But, you know, I think the broader point is the question of whether this is just individual officers who are acting out of line or part of a broader federal policy, I think is to some degree informed by statements senior officials are making. So there was this one statement by, I think it was the deputy director of the Federal Protective Service, who described one of the arrests that was captured on video and tried to defend what the officer was doing in a way that completely misdescribed what the Fourth Amendment requires. And so if that's what, you know, the senior officials are saying, if that's how they're understanding the constitutional questions, then I think it's little wonder that some of the line officers might also be crossing the line. That's where this lawsuit comes into play. That's where I think the courts are going to have a lot to sort out in the coming days and weeks.
Well, Steve, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think that more federal officers will be deployed in some of the other cities the president has mentioned before the courts have their say?
I mean, I do think that we're going to see more federal deployments across the country over the next couple of months. But, you know, just because there are more federal officers, say, on the ground in a city like Chicago or Detroit, doesn't mean we're going to see what's happening in Portland. I mean, I think the difference between Portland and everywhere else is in Portland, you have federal law enforcement officers going out into the streets and purporting to serve as the general riot police. I'd be very surprised if we see a lot more of that in other American cities, especially because I think that's the part of this that's going to cause the most heartache for the courts and potentially the most pushback against what the administration is doing.
Yeah. You know, the past 3 years have in many ways been a festival of experimentation and constitutional law professors, as the administration has, you know, tried some things that haven't really been a traditional part of presidential policy. Given some of the other conversations that have happened in terms of presidential privilege, how much of a departure is this compared with other constitutional conversations that have been playing out over the past 3 years?
So I think it's actually deeply consistent with some of the same problems we've seen in other contexts, where what's effectively happening is the administration is taking existing authorities and using them in ways that just haven't been used before and in ways that perhaps they ought not to be used. And so, you know, in some respects, what's happening in Portland and what might be happening soon in other cities is more of the same, which is an administration that is not bound by conventional political constraints and that is perfectly happy taking every legal authority it has to its breaking point, if not beyond.
You alluded to the fact that there may be elements of political theater in the deployment of the kind of federal troops that we're seeing in the streets on the West Coast. What is your read on how much of this is actually playing out for an, as someone said, an audience of one, meaning the president?
Oh, I think that's a big part of this. I mean, I think a big part of this is, you know, getting rave reviews from the audience of one, but also, you know, these videos from Portland and these images from Portland are showing up pretty quickly in campaign ads. And so I think it's been a conscious move on the part of the administration to make this part of their message, that, you know, what's going on in Portland is what people should expect if they vote for Joe Biden, whereas what's, you know, the pushback, the law enforcement response, the tamping down of what's happening is what you can expect from President Trump. You know, that's a message that resonated a lot in 1968 when it was Nixon running against President Lyndon Baines Johnson. But Nixon wasn't the incumbent. It's a bit odd for a president to, you know, be putting out images of unrest and saying, this is what you can expect if I lose, when he's the president now and it's under his watch.
Is there anything else that you think people should keep in mind as they consider the possibility of a federal deployment in Detroit, maybe how it is and isn't different from what's played out in Portland?
Well, I just, you know, I think the key is just the focus should always be, what are the federal officers doing? If all they're doing is enforcing federal law, if they're, you know, assisting local authorities with local requests, if they're, you know, looking into violations of federal statutes, then, you know, we might not agree with the prioritization of resources, but that's perfectly kosher, at least legally. Where things really, I think, have run awry in Portland is that I think there's increasingly little question that the federal government has gone past its statutory and constitutional mission. And that's the line that's, it's hard to draw, but it's critical to draw. And it's the one that we ought to be looking for if we see deployments like that in additional cities like Detroit.
Professor Steve Vladeck is at the University of Texas School of Law, and you may have heard him on the National Security Law Podcast. Steve Vladeck, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.